So thanks for taking your time to call me. John Flansburg of They Might Be Giants.
Well, thank you for taking the time to answer the phone, Matt.
It's my pleasure.
Cool.
So you got a new album coming out, right?
We have a brand new album coming out on March 5th. There's actually three preview songs that are available already that came out like a week and a half ago.
The Nanobots EP, right?
Exactly, yes.
Cool. Available on iTunes, Amazon, and Spotify, I think, right?
I believe so. Although I think Spotify has listed the Nanobots preview songs as being done by the group Nanobots.
it'd be
really interesting, you know, at this juncture in our career to suddenly find ourselves accidentally more popular because people didn't realize it was us. You know?
Yeah, that would be
I love this new band, Nanobots.
I actually think it's Nanobots EP.
Right,
band.
Right. No, Nanobots EP is much better than Nanobots UK.
Oh, man.
But years ago, like 10 years ago, I guess there was this band. You know, there's this thing about like UK bands especially where there's almost like a sell-by date on them. I mean, all through the 80s and 90s and while the sort of the NME kind of ruled that world, there was this, like, there are no second acts in being a UK pop band. Like, you'd be like, thank you very much. Now please go away. And I guess there was a band, I'm trying to think which band it was. It might have been The Alarm, but I'm trying to think. I'm not positive which band this was, but there was a band that had sort of had their shining moment for a couple of years with the British press and you know, had a good run up the charts, you know, and then kind of got the heave-ho from their label or whatever and fell out of favor. But the band was still very much, you know, active and doing creative stuff and felt like they were, you know, had a place in the contemporary world. And they actually released a single under a different name. And it was like, it got all sorts of attention.
Wow.
You know, it actually started going up the charts and people were, you know, people were like, it was getting really good reviews. And then, you know, basically as the whole thing was peaking out, they just said, "We're the Alarm, you know, like, why won't you give us a chance?" And of course, the response after that was like, "Oh, go away."
Oh, it's you guys again.
Don't try to trick us. Like, you, we hate you. So,
great. Is that the future of They Might Be Giants?
Well, yeah. I mean, well, you know, it's odd. I mean, truth be told, we're probably both more famous in Britain, and it's the only place where we really truly are has-beens, because we had chart hits in England, you know, a few times. And, you know, we got to play on Top of the Pops a few times. You know, we played on Top of the Pops like three times. And it's kind of interesting being, you know, shot out of that cannon, but it's definitely not – they do not need legacy careers there.
Right.
They're not having it.
Would you consider yourself bigger or smaller than The Alarm?
Oh, that's a really good question. You know, somebody was saying that a friend, I don't know if it was a friend of mine or if I actually read this in like some weekly, that they're saying that the true test of mediocrity in films is in film is if it's better or worse than the truth about cats and dogs. That if it's worse than the truth about cats and dogs, then it's a bad movie. And if it's better than the truth about cats and dogs, it's a good movie.
So truth about cats and dogs is like the center.
Yeah,
it's the
like
true
exactly,
neutral.
It's
movie.
Exactly in the middle. It is like the most purely mediocre movie. Like it's equal parts good and bad.
So is that the alarm the truth about cats and dogs?
Well, that's what I wonder. I mean, I don't know. You know, I think that The Alarm did not have a very long career. It's true.
Right.
I'm not sure. I think for somebody, if you're older, The Alarm might be much more famous than we are. But I think if you're younger, I think we have a much more fighting chance of being on your radar.
Honestly, John, I'm 19 years old. I've never heard of The Alarm.
See, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Alarm, shalarm, that sort of thing. The Alarm were kind of like what Stone Temple Pilots was to Pearl Jam. The Alarm kind of were to The Clash. They sounded very similar to They sounded very similar to The Clash.
Okay.
But
okay.
But they weren't as good as The Clash.
Right. So The Clash would be better than The Alarm.
The Clash are better than almost everything.
Everything. So Nanobots. What is new about Nanobots? What has changed since joined us? Or like, have you brought anything back? What's brand new? Like, tell us a little bit more.
That's a good question. I mean, I think over time, you know, I'll sort of feel like I have a better answer. In some ways, I think for us, Join Us was a very long experience. We spent a long time making the record, and we had a lot of false starts. I think we kind of started making that record at a very like low energy point for the band, but we were very tired when we started. I think when we started Nanobots, we were actually very excited about the whole experience of finishing and then touring behind Join Us, because it ultimately was a very successful record for us. I mean, it was a very, very positive experience, and the tour was extremely successful. I think, you know, we're kind of feeling jazzed right now about just the way the world is embracing what we're doing. You know, it's exciting to be to get such a good response. This album, there's some very strange things about this album. I mean, there's some very unusually spare recordings. There's like on this preview track, there's a song called Black Ops, which is just a vocal and percussion track. It's actually Marty Beller playing percussion and the drum kit, but there's really not a lot of instrumentation for 90% of the song.
Wow.
Besides the drums, you know, that's a very unusually spare arrangement for us, but I think it's really exciting, and it's actually kind of I feel like, you know, we're there's actually a lot of things on this record that are kind of almost done for the first time. I mean, we're approaching a lot of things in a much more stripped down, kind of minimal way, and that's just been the way we've been working for the past couple of years. And even when we work with the band, we don't do that many overdubs. You know, it's like a lot of times it'll just be three or four instrument and vocal, and so it's an exciting time for us, but I think part of it is because we're just more confident about working with less.
That's cool. Yeah. It's really like heartwarming to hear that you guys are still like doing new things. That's really exciting to me. Cause like you guys have been going at this for 30 plus years. I mean, are you tired? Well, how are you doing right now?
Well, I mean, I think if you ask, I mean, I'm 52 years old. So I think if you ask, you know, any 52-year-old, whether they're, your uncle in real estate or the dude in a rock band, if they're tired, they'll probably say yes. But there are times when I'm exhausted, but to be perfectly honest with you, I feel like we won the lottery, you know?
All right.
It's we've got an audience that accepts what we do, you know, even the most sort of unusual parts of what we do. It's not just like, you know, a lot of times, a lot of bands go on and on, but their audience really just wants one thing from them. And the thing that I'm really grateful for is that, you know, our audience, you know, will do something that's new, that's kind of uncharted territory for us, and people accept it pretty readily. Maybe that's just the nature of, you know, what they're accepting is that they are into this band that has this kind of experimental component in what they're doing, and that's what they're interested. They want to be part of that, you know, odyssey. But I think, you know, job satisfaction in They Might Be Giants is very high, you know.
Oh, that's great.
It's a good gig. I think, you know, people want different, you know, musicians want different things out of their professional career. I mean, I've got lots of friends who are musicians, and I know their frustrations. But to be perfectly honest, like, I never felt like playing in a nightclub was a compromise, you know. I think a lot of musicians, especially people who are like really technically gifted, like they actually have like a natural gift, often find the circumstance of being in like a dirty club to be just like not worth it. We worked with sidemen over the years, you know, guys who are like really, really good musicians, like gifted musicians.
Right.
And I can tell you, like, you know, they don't think of like having to go to the bathroom in a broken down, horrible, stinky rock hellhole they don't think of that as exactly a privilege, you know? It's like,
right.
It's not that they're going like, all my dreams are coming true.
Right.
You know, it actually seems like everything in my life has taken me to this horrible place, and this is beneath me, you know? It's like, so I guess, you know, we're uniquely adapted to survive, you know, in the world that we're in. You know, it doesn't bug us that much.
Huh.
It doesn't feel so crummy, kind of, you know, clawed our way to the middle, you know. But, the, you know,
cool.
The middle is a very, for a lot of people, is a very tenuous place. Like, it's not comfortable, I guess, is part of it. You know, it's not, there's a lot of travel. There's a lot of, there's a lot of, like, kind of not such glamorous living. So if that seems disappointing to you, then it's very possible that, you know, you would go out on a There Might Be Giants tour and go, hey, man, guess what? This stinks. So, I don't know. I guess I just sort of take it as sort of like a one-third full.
Wow. So you're satisfied, you know, where you are.
Well, I'm satisfied with some things, and I'm realistic about other things. And there's some things that, you know, that we can figure out, you know, some accommodation that makes it work. I mean, we don't do everything that we could do, that's for sure. You know, like I remember when Malcolm in the Middle theme was kind of taking off, and that Malcolm show was taking off.
Right.
All of a sudden, we had all these invitations to be on Fox affiliates in, like, you know, big cities. Like, we would get a phone call and be like, we want you to be our, you know, featured performer on Fox Morning Chicago. You know, we have average viewership of 2 million people every morning. And, you know, when your management office gets an offer like that, it sort of sounds like it's going to be cool. And then you get there and it's like, all right, guys, we've worked out like an agreement that you'll play outside the Countrywide Bank. It's a little cold. And
wow.
You can be there for 2 hours, and we're just going to pop over to you guys during the bumpers.
Oof.
For 15 seconds. And all of a sudden, like, you know, you look like a busker outside some corporate headquarters, and it's 40 degrees outside. And you know, what seemed like an opportunity actually is just kind of this horrible experience that you wish you could, that you wished would end as soon as possible. So, you know, that kind of stuff. It took a couple of years to figure it out, but you know. We're not doing the morning show television magazine appearances anymore.
Okay.
And I don't think anybody's missing that.
Yeah, I get that. That makes sense.
Yeah.
So you have your own label, right?
Yeah, our records are we've got like a label deal with this great new, I mean, it's a great new relationship for us. We're working with Megaforce Records, which is you know, they're basically started with Anthrax, and these guys they're fantastic because they're totally DIY. Like it's funny that you know, from a musical point of view, I think they're really on the sort of opposite ends of things. Like their logo is like this fantastic. It's like two fists in the rock, you know, doing the rock fist. And it's completely unironic. it's the most like carved into a desk at your high school rock logo you could imagine.
Oh, that's great.
And but they're great people, and they totally get us, and you know, they're really scrappy. You know, like they're just doing what they can do and finding the audiences that they can find. And I think we're actually very well suited to.
Oh, that's cool. It's very They Might Be Giants.
Exactly.
So,
Megaforce.
What's your experience been like on, like, other labels?
Well, you know, I think everybody has heard the sort of, you know, major label. You know, major labels are like this enormous cultural pinata that people seem to never tire of beating on. And there are definitely things about the majors that were kind of ridiculous. But they were sort of big time ridiculous rather than small time ridiculous. My first job was working in a record store. You know, I worked for Strawberry's Records when I was 17, and I saw a lot of that music industry from the bottom up. You know, I know a lot of people who worked in that world, And I don't, you know, I think there are things about the whole label business that are, the culture actually kind of, is already missing. I mean, one of the things about the label business, it's a very two-sided thing, because the labels were curators, you know, and they helped, and they were involved in developing talent and steering people, and sometimes that was very productive. Sometimes it's not bad for creative people to be challenged in different ways. You know, major labels and even small labels would often say, like, you know, you've got really good songs, but your bandmate is miserable, or like your show is too slow paced, or you'd get like critiques that you would never get from an audience, and you'd never get from a club owner. You know, you'd get kind of the tough love of somebody who's in a more avuncular position. Somebody that's on your side is going to give you constructive criticism. And I think what's happened now is it's such a free-for-all culturally that, you know, especially developing acts don't have much, there's not much, well, I mean, I guess there's always YouTube comments. there's not that much that you'd necessarily really take to heart or right, that exactly. perspective. I mean, we were on Elektra for 10 years, and there were years of that relationship that were incredibly positive and productive, and there were years of that relationship that really it just felt like we were working with an insurance company. You know, it didn't. I think. Benign neglect was as big a problem with being on a major label as actual, you know, it wasn't like villainy. It was just, we stopped being a priority act.
Right.
But you know, the major thing was very much about, you know, it was big time stuff. You know, they had a very unhidden agenda, which is, you know, they wanted to be on the radio and on TV and selling a ton of music. It wasn't like they figured everything that they were working with was good music. It was just more about like what's gonna get over, and that's the that was the challenge. And I think, you know, people who fail to have like commercial success kind of take it too personal. You know, if the major labels rejected them, because it's only about. I'm put it this way: the only reason we were ever on Elektra is because we sold a lot of records before we were on Elektra. You know, the people at Elektra knew about the A&R department of Elektra knew about They Might Be Giants in 1984, and they didn't sign it until 1989. And the thing that really changed in the interim was that we had sold hundreds of thousands of records on our own. I don't think if we hadn't sold records, they would never have offered us a deal. You know, I mean, we're just another bunch of weirdos from New York. I mean, who cares?
So, you are a lot more present on social media than you have, like, since when you started. Like, you've got your way, you know, up there on your new Tumblr blog, on Facebook, and on Twitter, and the avatar's Twitter. I mean, like, how has that affected your fan base?
I'm not really sure. It's something that I sort of do it for fun in a way, like just to keep, I just want to be able to keep in the mix of all those things that are happening. Some of it's really an interesting challenge. Like doing stuff on Twitter, I feel like everyone I know who's in the Twitter world now, suddenly, I feel like we're all suddenly realizing like the job here is to basically be a joke writer. You know, a lot of tweets are essentially one-liners.
Right.
So, you know, comedy really plays a big part in it. You know, just like doing cultural observation that's humorous is really a big part of it. We also just did this thing, They Might Be Giants iPhone app, which is really a nice, it's a beautiful little project that was put together by this fellow, Drew Westfall, who works with Jonathan Colton. He did all the code work for it. And our graphic designer, Paul Sayre, and a Japanese artist named Hine did the graphics. And it's basically, it's a very simple music streamer. you know, I had the idea to do this thing, but it's exactly the kind of thing that it's too hard to do. I mean, I would have to take a year off to figure out how to code it myself. But it's a really beautiful experience for us to just be able to launch stuff through an app. And it's free. So if you've never heard of They Might Be Giants, this is a perfect introduction.
Cool.
And I guess, you know, for us, it's always been about sort of finding an audience. You know, we want it, and the social media is a really great direct way to reach out to people and interact with people without it being too weird. It's incredibly personal, and yet it also has this, like, nice distance to it. And it's easier than being on tour 11 months of the year.
Would you consider this, like, another incarnation of the Dial Song, or is this just, like, a completely new thing that you guys are doing?
Well, it's interesting you ask that. You know, the iPhone app is very much like Dial a Song in that, you know, there's a new song every day, a different song every day. You know, and it really is this easy on, easy off, you know, exit ramp to They Might Be Giants music. We actually just called it They Might Be Giants because if we called it Dial Song, then, you know, a lot of people don't know what Dial Song
yeah.
is. So it's like, why bother naming yourself twice?
But, yeah, you did have that in mind? This is like...
Well, I mean, you know, Dial a Song is, you know, was a phone machine in the 80s. You know, this is a much more high-tech kind of thing. But I guess the simplicity of it does harken back to Dial a Song. I mean, Dial a Song was, when we started, for the first 5 years of Dial a Song, Dial a Song didn't even have an extra message. It just was a song. And then it just just hung up on you. So there was no... I remember when we first started touring, there was this weird thing about Dial a Song, which is there were people who would see the band perform live who didn't know that we were the people who did Dial a Song. They knew there was this Dial a Song number, and we were a band, but they didn't... I'm talking about people who were highly confused. They didn't necessarily make the connection that the people who were doing the Dial a Song service were the same people who were this band on stage. You know, Dial a Song was just a project that it was kind of disconnected. It was a faceless project. They just didn't make the connection.
Right. Okay. Cool. So that's interesting. I didn't know about like that disconnect between the band and the service.
Well, a lot of times the Dial a Song number would just be sort of passed around.
Right.
And it wasn't. Right. You know, I guess, like, you could do, like, a graduate seminar in branding over, like, what the Dial a Song thing did. Because people in the rock world, you know, they would just see Dial a Song as, like, this incredible advertising campaign for a band. But because it was kind of faceless and nameless, a lot of people heard about the Dial a Song thing but didn't really know that there was a band attached.
Yeah.
And it was years before we've even made records. You know, Dial a Song started in 83. We didn't have records in stores till like 87.
Wow.
So there was a good, you know, 4 years where it was just like this sort of urban legend of a thing.
Wow, that is really cool.
But it was a good introduction to the band for us. I mean, it was a good way to be introduced to people because it was so wide open. You know, being a band is such a predictable thing. It's like, what are they like?
Right.
What's their good song? You know, like there's something about, you know, new bands that can be very cookie cutter.
Yeah.
And having the Dial a Song as the entree just really reinvented the way people perceive the band.
Cool. So if someone asks me like, oh, what are they like? Who's They Might Be Giants? And download their iPhone app.
Exactly. And that'll be their introduction.
Right. That is coming soon to Android, right?
It's coming to Android. There's a guy working on the Android thing right now, and hopefully it'll be done soon.
Perfect.
I remember when we first started, we were signed to Rough Trade Records in England, which is like this very legendary kind of indie label. They put out our first record in England and probably sold 18 copies of it. But we were doing really well in Germany and doing a lot of German tours. But one thing that came up over and over again is there was a band called the Young Marble Giants. And they were a trio. It was two men and a woman, and it was like guitar, Casio, keyboard, and drum machine. So it wasn't that different in terms of sound from us. And on more than one occasion, we would sit down at these like to do interviews, like have a press day, and journalists would come in and they'd say,
So where is the girl? And we'd have to explain to them that we weren't a new version of the Young Marble John.
Wow.
Yeah. Pretty crazy. But you know what? Now I do have to go.
Okay. Well, thanks so much, John Flansburgh.
Max, thank you for the time. I hope we can talk again sometime.
Right on. Okay, rock and roll, dude.
Okay, cheers. Bye.
See ya.